What's good, family? I'm Nikisha Elise Williams, the host of Black and Published Podcast, and the author of the novel, The Seven Daughters of Dupree. This historical fiction novel is about the secrets kept between mothers and daughters over the course of seven generations, and is told backwards in time from 1995 to 1860. The Seven Daughters of Dupree was published January 27, 2026, and is available everywhere books are sold. So if you can, please consider getting a copy of The Seven Daughters of Dupree today.
It wasn't like, is there a career for me? Is there a path for me as a writer? Is there a path for me as a poet? Like, girl, what is that? Like, what does that actually look like, you know?
What's good? I'm Nikisha Elise Williams, and this is Black and Published on the Mahogany Books Podcast Network, bringing you the journeys of writers, poets, playwrights, and storytellers of all kinds. Today's guest is Danica Kelly, author of the poetry collection, The Natural Order of Things. It's a collection of poems paying homage to Danica's wife, her friends, and especially her family.
There's a poem in there about what we say when we play dominoes. And like, I just remember my cousin Jimmy saying, he called 10 points, Tennessee tidy all, booty nobody. And that's how we... And my cousin Jimmy is a mess, but he had a way with language.
In crafting this third collection of poems, Danica said she was able to use her love for other people in her life as a catalyst to fully love herself. As someone who struggles with depression, how she uses poetry to imagine a future that doesn't feel possible. Plus, the comfort she finds in the natural world at a time of climatological catastrophe. And why she says she's never writing toward a book, and how that lax approach helps to keep the work fun. That and more is next when Black and Published continues. And just a note, there is a discussion of depression and suicidality. Please be tender with your hearts and minds when listening. Danica, when did you know that you were a writer?
I started writing when I was in high school. Before that, my relationship to writing was that I hated it and I thought it was stupid, which is reasonable because writing is hard. It's really hard to do. And I had a few experiences specifically writing poetry that were just like very emotional, and I didn't really like that. But at some point in late high school, I started writing poems. Before that, I was writing mostly bad fan fiction and sharing it with my teachers, who were very, very kind. They were incredibly kind women. But I started writing poetry and I shared the work with those teachers and they were so supportive. So I knew that I liked to write and that there was something in it that at least was encouraged by other people. But I would say it wasn't until maybe late in college that I thought, maybe this is a thing. Like I might be a writer.
Why poetry?
It's the best one. I'm not afraid to say it. Most poets are not afraid to say it.
All the shade. All the shade for us fiction writers out
no,
here.
No, not at, just... not at all. just description. No shade, just description. Poetry is the first thing that I really liked about it is that it is little. So with prose, it's so much typing. It's just like y'all are out here, my wife out here just typing and typing and typing and typing, hours and hours of typing. She comes out of the room sweating. I wrote 2,000 words. And I'm like, why? Like, why did you do that? So that's the first part. But the second part, and I think the part that has felt the most sustaining, is that poetry is so open. People have been doing it for such a long time. It's thousands and thousands of years old. It's one of the oldest human art forms. And there's something really lovely about that. But also there's a kind of pressure release because I don't have to be good. We've been doing this for 3,000 years. Like, it doesn't matter if I'm a good poet. I can just be one drop in the stream of poetry. And that feels really beautiful to me. And also just kind of scales what feels possible to do. Am I going to write something that's going to be read 1,000 years from now? Unlikely. So can I just have a good time right now? Can I have a good time today? Can I do the work that feels meaningful to me? And I don't know how prose writers relate to this because, again, it's an alien
As a
practice.
prose writer, that's not it. At least for me, at least for this prose writer, it's not that. I would love that sense of, we've been doing this for thousands of years, so let me just do what feels fun today. Yeah, no, I don't ever know. Ugh,
That
I
sounds
would.
hard. I'm so sorry.
Maybe I should rethink my life choices.
No. I mean, the other thing that's really wonderful, poetry is so open. Like anybody can do it, and anybody can be good at it, and good is described or understood as different in different spaces. So when my great aunt died, at her funeral, there was a man who got up to read a poem. I didn't read a poem because I knew whatever poem I was going to write would not be appropriate for the space. But this guy got up and he read a poem. And the poem was a persona poem in her voice about her going to heaven. It was rhyming couplets. It was gorgeous. It was one of the most beautiful experiences I've had at a funeral. I don't like funerals, but that moment of him reading that persona poem, sharing, like just like giving people an idea of both how much he knew her and loved her and imagined an afterlife for her of being reunited with people she loved. I just could not have done that. Like, that's not in my wheelhouse. That's not where my imagination goes. And it was just so beautiful. And it was a perfect poem for the moment and the space. And that's what I love about poetry is that you don't have to have like decades of training. You can be like, I have a poem in my heart. I know poems rhyme. I'm gonna hit you with these couplets about Miss Bean, you know? And then, like, I was crying. I was absolutely like, yes, this is exactly what we needed. People were laughing. It was so perfect. Does this man write poems in his day-to-day life? I don't think so. I think it was an occasion. And I love that about poetry. It's really open for people to write into and feel into.
Where did your imagination take you when you got to those latter years of undergrad that you said, you know what, I can be a poet and I can do this thing? What did you see for yourself?
I didn't see very much. I mean, in part, so part that there are like a couple of reasons for that. One of them is I'm a depressive and the future is hard, and trying to imagine into a future is really challenging. But the summer before my senior year, I got into this summer program that is now called the Bucknell Seminar for Undergraduate Poets. And the poet Terrence Hayes was on faculty. So this is before he's a MacArthur Award winner. This is before he's Terrence Hayes, and he's there with his family. And we had a one-on-one meeting, and he said to me, if you got into here, you can get into an MFA program. And I said, what's an MFA program? Because I went to a tiny state school in Arkansas that is not known for sending its alums to graduate school, especially in the arts. And so no one in the English department knew what an MFA program was. They knew I was writing poetry. They were very supportive, but it just wasn't on the radar of the faculty. And
Pause. So,
so,
like, none of the faculty had MFAs?
no, they all had PhDs, but the MFA was not, they weren't hanging out with writers. And so I think they just like didn't know about it. And Southern Arkansas University, where I did my undergrad, is just like, it's in a tiny, tiny town in Arkansas. So it's not connected to those networks. Like, it's a school that's now known for like engineering, and it was known for its nursing program and for the business school, and it's like an ag school, you know? So it's like, it's country. Like, that's where I was. And but Terrence just like opened up a path, and I applied to MFA programs. I said, okay, I'll do this. I didn't know what an MFA program was. I hadn't really done workshop. I didn't know anything. And also, I was 21. So I show up to the MFA program at the University of Texas, the Michener Center. And all of my peers are people who just like knew so much more than I knew. And I recognized that immediately. And so I was like, well, let me just like do my work, write my poems, which I love, and just try to get as much practice as I can. After the MFA program, I went into a PhD program in English and literature because I like going to school and I don't like to work. And I was just like on fellowship. I was just like, let me keep the fellowship train rolling. I really like being in classes. I really like talking about books. I really like talking about literature. I find that so fun. And I did that. And it was there that I wrote my first book. And still, I don't know that I saw like a path forward as a writer or a future as a writer. I was just writing. And I was just doing it because it was a part of my life. It felt good. It was anchoring and it was so affirming. Like I could write a poem, especially after the MFA program, I could consistently write a poem that I thought was good. And if anyone invited me to do a reading, I was there with my little pages. I was like, let's go. It wasn't like, is there a career for me? Is there a path for me as a writer? Is there a path for me as a poet? Like, girl, what is that? Like, what does that actually look like, you know? And I didn't really know, even after the MFA program, I didn't really know people or what the shape of a life might look like as a writer. It was not my background, like everyone in my family. I would say works like a regular job, a lot of blue collar work. Like right now, my family has a business and it's like HVAC, you know? And so the arts is
Not
uncharted
a real thing.
territory.
It's not a real job. It's not a real place.
Or just like it's unknown, right? So it's like, what is that? Like, I think in my family, a lot of us, like my sister and my brother, and now my niece and my nephews, like everyone makes music. I remember being in college and all the time I was in grad school, like my sister and my brother and my mom's younger brother would like record songs. My uncle and my brother would be rapping. My sister would sing the hook. They burn the CDs. My mama would play the CDs in the car. It's like, that's what you do. Like, you make your art, you share it, you love it. Do you monetize it? No. You know, it's separate from, or at least that was how I kind of understood it or saw it play out. It's like, you make it, it's a part of your life, but it's not where the money's coming from.
More hobby than career. Okay. So then you seem to have just fallen into a life of academia, because I know if you're in the fellowship programs and getting the MFA and PhD, you're also teaching. So there's some income there. And then you put together your first collection. What does that look like for you as a poet, putting together a collection and kind of just navigating through this unknown terrain?
I think a PhD program is a great place to put together a poetry collection. A PhD program in literature, because there was zero pressure on my poetry. There was no one who was asking for it. I mean, it was a solid like 8 years of no one asking for anything. No one was like, please, Danica, give us your poems. So I had to love the poems and I had to find community. And there were a lot of writers in the PhD program at Vanderbilt who had gotten MFAs. So there were a lot of us around. So we would form these writing groups that might last for like 6 weeks and then dissolve, but then maybe a couple of us in there would kind of keep going. So I was showing my manuscript to lots of people. There was a poet at Vanderbilt in the MFA program there named Mark Jarman, and he offered to look at my manuscript. And I wasn't his student. I'd never taken a class with Mark, and he gave me invaluable feedback. He suggested that I take something out of the book, and he was like, something else needs to be here. And I think he wanted something that had a little bit more heft, a little bit more weight, something that was more direct than the other poems in the book. And I had something that went in there. And once I plugged that poem into the collection, I was like, oh, it's done. And I would say I was probably about 3 or 4 years into the PhD program before that happened. So I had like lots of versions of the manuscript that I was sending out to contests, probably starting in the second year. So I
Wow.
was just like, somebody take this book. It's so good. It's so good. It got close a few times. It was a finalist for some prizes, but it was just me like just shuffling my little pages around and sharing it with people. And so there's only one poem from my MFA thesis that made it into the first book.
And that first book was Bestiary, right?
That's right.
You talked about sending it out from your second year and then getting the note from Mark and taking the one poem out and putting a new one in. And knowing then that it was done. After that moment, how long did it take you to win a contest or a prize that led to your publication of the collection?
It was another 2 or 3 years. I was a finalist for the Cave Canem Prize. Then the next year, it wasn't a finalist for anything. And then the year after that, it won. And that was the year that Nikki Finney judged. And that was also the year that Cave Canem was partnered with Grey Wolf to do the publication. So I would say, as annoyed as I was, because I was annoyed, I was like, why is this taking so long? This book is so good. I'm so good. Like,
I love the
who?
confidence.
It's gotten me through a lot, especially around writing. You know, it's just like, I love my work so much. It's just like, I know when I get the feeling, like I write something and I read it and I'm like, whoo, okay, you know what you're doing. Like, this is good. I can't wait to share this with someone else. But the timing was so beautiful and so perfect. to have Nikki Finney choose the book to get to work with Grey Wolf. And Grey Wolf is a press that keeps its authors. Like, if you have something, they want to see it. And if your work does well, they really want to see it. And so, I mean, I know people who have had first books that have done really well. And then when it's time for the second book, the press that they're with doesn't do second books. And so they have to go find another press. And I was just really, really grateful not to have to figure that out. Like, I landed in the cream. Grey Wolf is a phenomenal press with great people, and they really put a lot of energy behind the books. And it couldn't have been a better situation.
And so now this is your third book that we're here to talk about today with Grey Wolf, The Natural Order of Things. When did this start and where did it come from?
So in 2022, I met with my editor, and it had been a year since my second book had been out. And I said to him, I think I'll have something for you at the end of 23. And he was like, okay, sure. But I had had the thought sometime in 22 that I had enough poems to start thinking about a book, but I didn't know what that might look like. I'm a poet who just writes poems. So I'm not ever writing a book. I'm writing individual poems. Sometimes I start to notice there's a theme and I'm like, these poems feel connected to the theme, so I'll just kind of keep that in mind, but I'm not writing towards a larger project when I'm sitting down to write a poem. I'm just writing whatever comes. This is also why it's fun. I just do whatever feels nice, you know, whatever feels interesting, whatever feels forward, whatever feels like it's going to be really fruitful. So I had poems from 2016. I had a lot of love poems because in 2016, 2017, I met my now wife. And so I had all of these love poems about the beginning of the beginning. And I was like, I think those will be in there. And I've been writing these poems that use the language of my family. And my family's language is so beautiful. It's country. I wouldn't even say Southern. I feel like it's just country. And my family is really great with figurative language. Like, it's just so fun to listen to people talk. I'm like constantly sort of like being like, I'm gonna steal that. I'm gonna take that. I'm gonna take that. But I moved to Iowa in 2020, and it's dry up here. It's dry. The people, there's not a lot of figure. The accent is not interesting. It's real dry. And I was like, I need something that's a little bit, you know, I need some sauce. And I was like, who got it? Like, my family. And so I really just like wanted to hear like the richness and the fullness of my family's language here in the place where I live. And so I started just working on these poems where I was just exploring the language, and that felt really good. And so I had a lot of poems, and I just like put them all on the floor. You know, poets are always talking about that thing. It's like you get a big table and you put everything out on the table and you start organizing it. Have you heard this?
I have, and it always confounds me because you can't do that with fiction, at
That's
least
right.
not like that.
No, you have to like draw like a plot graph or something and like an out, you got to work with your outline. I don't know what fiction writers do. I have no idea.
I just
So.
pray about it and ask the ancestors and the spirits, like, what comes next? Like, literally, no joke. I'm at the computer, like, all right, y'all, what comes next?
Yeah. And I can, you know, I can have that a little bit in a poem, but then it's like I have all these pages. So then it's like, okay, what seems to be coalescing? What poems seem to be speaking to each other? Just putting them all out on the floor and making an order. And it's so nice to work also with like the hard copies. And again, poems are so small. So it's like I have like one or two pages, that's a whole poem. So I can really see what the early drafts of the book looked like. And I just carried around that sheaf of papers for almost 2 years, just moving things around, shuffling things around. So the earliest poems are from like 2016, 2017. There's a poem in there from 2023, a couple of poems that I wrote with my students here at the University of Iowa. And I realized that there were four movements in the book. I had these four sort of sections that seemed whole, but also were speaking to each other. So it's the family poems, it's falling in love, it's going to see art, and it's figuring out how to be alone, but not lonely. Like to know that I'm loved, to know that I'm with other people, even if we aren't together. And the practice of writing gives me some of that, reassures me of that. And yeah, I think the book ends with like a love poem, more love poems for my sweetie. I love writing love poems, so fun. And I just felt really excited. I was like, oh, this book isn't sad. Like, what a miracle.
Okay, so two things. I'm glad I got it because as I was reading, I was like, okay, I see the section. So, like, had my little notes in the margins of how I broke them up in the movements. I was like, okay, so we got the family poems, then we got the love poems, then I was like, we got protest poems and friend poems, and then we have love and longing poems. So I was like, I get it. Also, I was very excited to do this interview because I'm nosy, because I read your
Oh yeah.
wife's book, The Dry Season.
Oh yeah.
And I was like,
Yeah.
oh, I'm gonna be so nosy. Cannot wait to dive in. So I just wanted to put that disclaimer in there.
It's one of the things that's really great about being with her is that we are similarly nosy, like you, right? So we're like, we want to know other people's business. The poets who I love, they're writing about their business. I'm like, tell me what's going on. I want to know, like, what are y'all up to? And I think because of that, we're interested in that level of sharing vulnerability, transparency on our own work. And so this is the second time that we've had a book out at the same time. Oh, and it's really, and it just, I mean, like both of our, like what we, in 21, The Renunciations came out and Girlhood came out. And both of those books are so sad. And so it's nice for both of us to have like books that are not sad that are out at the same time.
Yes, because her book is dedicated to you. Your book is dedicated to her. Her book kind of ends where you all finally meet and like first start
Oh,
dating. And then
yeah.
your book starts, you had those early love poems. I was like, I'm all in the business. So without further ado, can you read some poems, like three poems from The Natural Order of Things, and then we can get further into the text?
Okay, that sounds great.
The Natural Order of Things by Danica Kelly is a poetry collection that shows both love and reverence in four movements toward Danica's first loves, her friends, her family, as well as her wife, the famed memoirist Melissa Phoebos. The fourth movement also shows love to the contentedness of being alone while observing the beauty in everything from the sea anemone to the weeping willow tree and all the creatures of the natural world. Here's Danica.
I'll read a poem from the beginning, from the first section. I'll read a love poem, and then maybe I'll read,
Can you read Major Arcana?
and I'll read that. That sounds great.
Okay.
All right. So, okay. So this is Tell It Short. I'll tell it short, like Miss Jewel. First, the homeless summer, everything I owned packed into a blue tub and my red car's trunk, and where to go? My great grandma, a new widow, and this summer, the first in 63 years without her Zach. Julie, my dear, sitting by the window, peeping the shifting light, calling, who knock? When I knocked, then stumbled into the house of cut off of scrap lumber, hot and damp as a mouth. And thank God for the porch that whistled the breeze where we sat and sweat. And couldn't Miss Jewel talk? And weren't the stories always the same? How I know I came honestly to refrain. Didn't I come bearing what gifts could delight, what token I could afford? Sugar-free peppermints and sugar-free ice cream. And quick, she say, put a piece in my hand or put a little in a bowl. I'm telling you, we hopped over in the bed together in the evenings, the old fan pushing air hot as my own skin and the blood besides. And grandma murmuring, that fan is a little cool, isn't it? Pulling the quilt up to her neck. I'm telling you, I was little and lost the season I learned to be still. To pass a piece of time with remembering, a comfort to remember now, to make present for a little while, to bring her as from a great distance closer. Self-portrait as a body, a sea. I am a body schooling, a ball of fish flashing and many in these early days of feeling, of love. When I learned hours ago of fish songs that swelled like bird song in the morning, how they foghorn or buzz for food or mates or space, I thought, now, aren't I a humming thing? Yes, you say, a body of oceans and marvelous. And the sea anemone in me, growing on the wreckage of an old ship. Can they grow that way, I wonder, on an ending? Still, this bright and tentacled anthozoan polyp, which reaches and filters whatever it needs from this strong current, and the current, too, that carries the sea cucumbers, the rough mammals, the life, both vertebrate and invertebrate, even the batfish, the black jewfish, and the pteropontid. It all swells and breaks in me like a chorus at dusk. Major Arcana. I've done today what I know best, struck out with a soft heart and the day's wet heat, unseasonable, this weather, unreasonable, this longing, yet both one alongside the other, companions for the day's practice, a praise song to youth, and I love you, I miss you, to my heart, bread broken with two women, not mirrors of me or one another, but resonances. Oh, Audrey, at times I have called on you as others might a power higher than their own. Oh, Lord, who might have walked alongside me, mouth a firm line when I ask how to bear this loneliness, this ache, who might respond exquisitely, with excellence, with chaos, with whatever yellow light you've got.
Thank you. So you talked about the structure being in the four movements for family, for your love, for your friends, and then for longing, as I termed it. And they all come across to me, once you say that's the structure, as like ode poems, like it's an ode or a tribute to. Why were those the things that you wanted to pay tribute to in this collection?
Yeah, it's interesting. I had paid tribute to them in the poems. Like, I just had so many poems. And so sometimes it's observing what is already there, right? So it's like I have this material. I have these poems that are in the language of my family. There's a poem in there about what we say when we play dominoes. And I don't say that explicitly in the poem, but I think people know if you play dominoes and you have a shit talking family. And like, I just remember my cousin Jimmy saying, he called 10 points Tennessee tidy all booty nobody. And that's how he. And my cousin Jimmy is a mess, but he had a way with language. And so I remember writing that poem and just being like, I want to get this thing that Jimmy said in the poem. So that was one of the impulses for that work. I had all of these love poems that I wrote at the beginning of the beginning with Melissa. I had gone to see some art and I've been thinking about what it means to see art in public spaces or in museum spaces. Gone to the opera many years ago for the first time and had like a truly revelatory experience. So I just like, I had these poems that were grouped together. And then I had like the second group of love poems that were also poems about if I could love my friends, if I could love Melissa, could I also love myself? Right. And if I could love my family and I could love art, could I also love myself? And how could I do that? What does that look like? So part of the work of putting the book together was just recognizing what I had already done and figuring out how those parts spoke to each other. Like, what was a shape that would bring forward that ode feeling? What is a shape that would encourage both me and a reader to feel the expansion that I'd begun to experience across the time that I was writing these poems?
And so then, with that said, it's clear that in the sections, you obviously love your family, you obviously love your wife, and you obviously love the art world, not just poetry, but like the arts at large. And then, so that last section, did you come to a point of realizing that you do love yourself?
That might be one way to describe the arc of the book. I do think I came into loving myself more fully through how I loved my friends. And I could figure out how to be with and in a relationship with Melissa through how I loved my friends. Like, I think that has been like the steadiest, healthiest love that I've experienced is with my friends. Everyone always wants to go for a walk, except my friend Elizabeth. Like, she and I can sit, you know, in San Antonio and drink agua frescas, and that'll do. Like, everyone else is like, we got to get our steps in, you know? And I don't believe in that, but, you know, I like to hang out with my people. So we're often out going for walks. So I think through loving them, I actually fig could figure out how to love my family. I could figure out a way to be close with my family that felt safe. I could figure out how to be in relationship, like in a romantic relationship, and ask for and expect and show up for a relationship where we got to be individual. Because that's the thing about friendship. I don't ask my friends to change because they're my friends. They're my friends because of who they are. So if I'm with Melissa, can I love her for who she is and not necessarily ask her to bend or change to move towards me, but can we move towards each other, you know? Because I think that's the movement of good friendship is like moving towards each other and having that trust that if we haven't talked in a long time, we still love each other. My best friend, sometimes we don't talk for like months. And then we're back on the phone and it's like we just got off the phone yesterday, you know? And so can I cultivate that energy inside of that relationship? And through those practices, I think I did figure out something about how to love myself, which has been long, slow work. So I feel grateful to the poems for charting that, for being a record of that.
Reading the collection, I think I noticed the depression or the depressiveness as an undercurrent, but the title of the last poem is still kind of jarring because all the other ones are such not necessarily enamored, but like there's a steadiness there. And so you end the collection with Suicide Watch Spring, but it's the last two lines where I'm like, okay, we're at peace, where you say, I'm happy sometimes to be alive, that such happiness could have happened at all. In your other works, did you think that that was not a possibility for you?
I did not think that that was a possibility, especially in the first book. I think in Bestiary, I really was just trying to find my way out of something, but I was so low. Like in the writing of those poems, I was just like in an incredibly low space. And towards the end of my time at Vanderbilt, right after I've defended my dissertation, I went into a partial hospitalization program. So it's an outpatient psychiatric treatment. And I wasn't having a psychiatric break or anything. My suicidality had just like reached a point where I was like, this is not, I can't deal with this. Like, I don't know how to manage this. I don't know how to live with this feeling, but I keep living. So what do I do? And so that program was incredibly helpful for giving me some different kinds of language and framing for what I was experiencing. So one of the things that I left that program with was that my suicidality was a coping mechanism, which was just like super helpful. A coping mechanism is something I can change. And so that was really the beginning of a really big shift in how I understood my depression, how I understood what might be possible. And I was like 30. And so I've been depressed, I think, for like my whole life, like before that. Like just like truly, like as a child, as a teen, all of my 20s. And that hasn't gone away, but I know how to manage it.
Do you recognize your writing and poetry specifically as one of the ways that you were actively saving yourself, even though you didn't realize it until you were already a book deep?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Poetry has been this place and has been a practice where I can say anything. And that is now more true in my life because of the kind of person I am now. But before that, I think I was so careful before I started writing and understood myself to be a writer. I was so careful with my family. I wanted to protect people. I didn't want to hurt anybody. But in poetry, I could say anything. And at a certain point, I was like, oh, this is my speaker. This isn't me. And there's like the distance and the manipulation of how much the speaker looks like me or doesn't look like me allows for me to say things that I wasn't able to say as me. Poetry can help us imagine futures that don't feel possible. We can say things in poems that might not be true for us right now, but that we want to be true. That they can be a space where we are reaching into the future or calling toward a future that we want. And I think that's also been some aspect of my own practice, that because of my friends and because of the huge privilege of being both published and read, that I've had the opportunity to get to reflect on my work and talk to people about my work. So then I've come into an understanding of my work that's fuller, that's deeper. I can figure out what I'm doing or what it is that I have done.
I can understand how you write something and it's the speaker. But I feel like in the natural order of things, there's no question that you are owning the role of speaker. Like there's no more duality, at least necessary. So do you feel more comfortable in like standing in the truth of your work and your words and letting people know, this is how I feel, good, bad, or indifferent?
Yes, that is true now. But it was not true. I think I had to do all of the other work to get to a place. And it's a lot easier to stand in the truth of just being like, I'm in love. You know, like that's like a lot easier than I'm a depressive. And being alive is a challenge because that's hard for people to hear. So in this book, early on, there's a lot of we say this. This is what we say. So there's the poem, It's Gonna Be What It Is. And it's just like stuff that we say in my family. And I really like that we. There aren't a lot of spaces where I feel comfortable with the we of my family. But that is one. And so just like thinking about all the fun things that we say. Like, I love it's gonna be what it is. It's not a hopeful phrase. It's like, whatever it is right now, that's what it's gonna be. Or it's fate. I can't stop what's gonna happen. So there's a kind of foreclosure. But it sounds so good. It's going to be what it is. I don't know, man. And there's a sort of seeding of, I can try to impose my will, but what's going to happen is going to happen. And so I love like that, like really thinking like deeply and into the we that I can be a part of in my family. That's a way that my speaker can be close to family. That's a way that I can be close to family. So I think the separation between myself and my speaker is like very slender, very slim right now.
You touched on this a little bit before, but I want to go back. What has your family taught you about how to bend a phrase and bend the language that you use?
What comes first to mind is that we don't have to say things in the most straightforward way, that putting a little figure on it can make it much more evocative. Remember my Uncle Art, who's a very sweet man. He's incredibly, incredibly sweet. We were at a family reunion at my great grandparents' house, and he's the oldest of my great grandparents' children. So he's my grandpa's oldest brother. And my Uncle Art, who's so sweet, was drunk, standing on the steps, and he had a little tiny penknife. It was so small. And he's just standing there, like swaying on the porch. And to somebody, nobody, he just goes, "I gut you like a hog." And I was like, "With that? But who is he talking to?" Nobody. I was just like, "Uncle Art was," and I just heard it. He wasn't talking. Again, no idea what the situation was. But I think about that. Or my sister, I sent her a picture of Lake Michigan, and she said, "I love the way it's running with the sky." And I was like, "That's gonna be in a poem at some point. I haven't figured it out yet, you know." And she knows that I'm just stealing. I'm like, I stole that. I'm stealing that, you know. She's very generous. My mom is so funny. My dad, who's a terrible person, also has some really beautiful turns of phrase, you know. I think I recognize the delight that we have in language.
Leaning into that delight, the stories that you've just told often feature much of the natural world and what's happening in nature. You've got raccoons and sea anemones in the collection. What do you learn from your observance and I'm going to assume reverence of the natural world?
There are a few things that I learned. I think reverence is right. I have a deep appreciation for the natural world of which we are a part. The most comforting lesson, the most comforting observation that I have made and that I keep making is that we are not the center. Humans are not the center. And like, what a relief, because we're doing a bad job if we're at the center. Like, but if we're just like another animal that makes its habitat, changes the world around it, lots of other animals do this, right? And I love that. It is deeply comforting to me. There are lots of things happening in the world that we live in with lots of other creatures, lots of other beings, and they are not dependent on us.
So then, with this deep reverence for the natural world and this love for your friends and family and art and yourself, what is the natural order of things?
When I think about the title, it feels right, like the right title for the book. And maybe it's the natural order of things for me. It feels like the shape of the book is what I want the shape of my life to be, you know? So it's like, how can I be with my family? How can I stay connected to the feelings of being in love at the very beginning of the beginning? It's not the same. Like Melissa and I have been together almost 9 years. And right now is not then, you know, but it's like, how do you sustain it? How can I stay connected to those feelings and also really love where we are? Like, not to mourn those feelings, because I think there are people who are like, well, it used to be like this and now it's like this. It's like, how can I delight in what has happened and be curious about what will happen? How can I be in the stream of my life? And I think that title is maybe a way of trying to claim something. That, like, this is how I would love for it to be.
I love that. All right. So I want to play a little game in a speed round before I let you
Oh,
go for
okay.
the
Okay, I'm ready.
afternoon. No pressure, but maybe a little bit. What is your favorite book?
Natasha Trethewey's Belloc's Ophelia.
Who was your favorite author?
It's a fight, and Lucille Clifton is winning, but Marie Howe is over there. It's Marie Howe and Lucille Clifton, but Lucille Clifton's winning. But, and I think Marie would say that's right. So.
Who's your favorite poet? Just so you can just go ahead and be both right.
Like, now I have the opportunity to put another name out there. So, like, we can count those first three. Definitely some of my favorite poets, like my top three. And I would add in there Carl Phillips. It's a surprise. But yes, I think that's right. He's beautiful. He's a beautiful writer. It's hard. It's a lot of syntax, but it's weird in there. I like it.
Name a poet you think people don't know enough about.
I'm gonna say the poet Catherine Barnett, who is a beautiful, she's weird. Her poems are so strange. I don't know that she's necessarily underread, but she's one of my favorites. Lots of people don't talk about her very often.
What is the difference, if you think there is a difference, between poetry and spoken word?
I don't think there's a difference. I think poetry is the umbrella, and spoken word is under that umbrella with lots of other kinds of practices and forms.
If money were no object, where would you go? What would you do? And where would you live?
There are two places that I really want to go to. One, I would like to go to South Africa and do some whale watching because they have a little whale watching infrastructure, and I would like to see some whales off the continent. I think that would be a lot of fun. And I would also like to see the Alps because they're really big, and I'm a sucker for big things. I really like to be around big structures and animals, and I don't know where I would live. It's this country is hard and the world is hard, and I don't know that there's a place that feels like, I mean, I have a super boring answer, which is like it would be great to go to Western Massachusetts. So I know Western Mass, it doesn't make a whole lot of
But
sense.
it's so specific.
It is very specific. My sweetie's mom is not too far away. We can take a train down to the city, but we have the country and it's full of lesbians. So,
Okay, got it. Got it. Name three things on your bucket list.
I'll tell you something tricky about my bucket list. I don't know what's on it until I'm sort of halfway in it. Like, I went to Alaska in June, and I think it was like 2 days before I was like, oh, this is on my bucket list. So I'm not like super connected with my bucket list. It's like there's a secret list inside me. It's like need to know. And
Think this is just the way that you approach life, and I don't know you that well to say that, but like from your story of how you got to poetry and this now secret inside bucket list that only makes itself known in the activity, I think this is just how you operate.
think that's right. I think that's right. It's curious. I think some of that is not having a strong sense of the future. So let's go back to the South African coast, the Alps. I'd like to go to South America, the southern part, go maybe down Patagonia. I think that's the southern part of South America and do some more whale watching. Really like to see whales. So, but I got to work on my Spanish. My Spanish is deeply insufficient. And with all of these places, like I don't want to go somewhere like a stereotypical American. So I want to have a little something on me.
What brings you joy?
Finding out things on my secret bucket list. No, what brings me joy? I mean, reliably is being with my beloveds. So being with my friends, none of them live very close. So when I can make time or they can make time and we can see each other, that is, it makes me really, really happy. I have really, really good friends, good sweeties all the way around. So
And what brings you peace?
not having to go to work, but still getting a check.
Hey.
Summertime's almost over, but I had it. It was really nice. So.
Right, so our game is called Rewriting the Classics. Classic is however you define it. Name one book you wish you would have written.
Is it like the same book, but then I just get to put my name on it? Because I would put my name on Beloved. I would be like, I wrote that.
So many people say Beloved. It's like a standard answer. So
Okay,
who
wait, let me give you another answer, because I just like, if that's the, but it, okay, so let me think. I would say if I could be the caliber of poet who could write something like Lucille Clifton's The Terrible Stories, like that would be, I mean, I don't have that either. I don't have whatever Lucille Clifton had, but, or Good Woman. Oh my God. Have you read this book, Good Woman?
No, but now I need to. Name a book where you want to change the ending, and how would you do it?
I'm gonna go classic. So at the end of Anna Karenina, she throws herself in front of a train. It's fine. It's foregrounded at the beginning. You know it's coming. This book is super old, so I feel like we're outside the spoiler range. But I just, that early in the book, he writes that when people throw themselves in front of the train, it throws off everybody's day. And I'm like, girl, she had access. This is also my critique of Madame Bovary. I'm like, they had access to opiates. You want to kill yourself? This is again like a depressive. I'm like, there are some less intrusive ways to do this. This is a lot of steps. And so it's not that I think Anna killing herself at the end of the novel doesn't make sense. I want to respect that choice. She really got into a pickle, but I also feel that she had access to opiates. There was laudanum around. She was actually taking it, I'm pretty sure, if I'm remembering correctly. So I'm like, you didn't have to do the train. It's too much. And I think that is like a man's drama, right? Like a man riding a woman. He's like, this is what she would do. And I'm like, I don't think that's what Anna would have. Didn't feel true to the character.
Final question for rewriting the classics, and it's my messy question, and you can do
Okay.
dead people. Name a book that you think is overrated or overtaught, professor, and why?
I actually want to say a film. Will that work? So often in film classes, I don't know if this is still true, but when I was in grad school, Birth of a Nation was taught multiple times. And I do think there's a way to teach that film as an example of the white imagination, which is not how it's taught. I think there's a way to teach that film in that way, but it is often taught as like, look at the technical achievement of the film.
The groundbreaking cinematography of the cross on fire that then the real Klan then imitated in real life to terrorize Black people. Yeah.
And so, if you really want to, I just feel like there are some other D.W. Griffith films that are doing something that is not that.
Can we just not teach him?
Could we just not teach him? I would say that's one that I think we could probably let go. We probably could have let go a long time ago. So hopefully people aren't teaching it as much. That's my hope. But it sounds like you've seen it.
I've seen it at least twice.
Yeah, I think I've seen it 3 times, and it was all class related. So,
Yeah.
yeah.
All right. Final question. When you are dead and gone and among the ancestors, what would you like someone to write about you and the legacy of words and work that you left behind?
My first thought was, that's not my business. I can't worry about what those
But
people
it's
are
so
up to.
triggering because it's like, I'm dead. Why do I care? I get
don't.
it.
So that was my first thought. That's not my business. My second thought is that I had friends and that I was loved and that I loved. And I feel like that comes through in the work. And if that's held as and understood to be something important about the work, that if I could care from beyond the grave, I would be happy to know that.
Big thank you to Danica Kelly for being here today on Black and Published. You can follow Danica on the socials at Danica Kelly on Blue Sky. And make sure you check out The Natural Order of Things. It's out now from Grey Wolf Press. You can get a copy of the collection from Mahogany Books and get 10% off your first purchase using code BLACKPUB at checkout. That's BLKPUB. That's our show for the week. If you like this episode and want more Black and Published, head to our Instagram page. It's at Black and Published, and that's BLK and Published. There, I've posted a bonus clip from my interview with Danica about the biggest challenge she faces, learned from her family, when crafting a poem on the page. Make sure you check it out. Let me know what you think in the comments. I'll holler at y'all next week when our guest will be Jodi Ann Bury, author of the book Authentic, The Myth of Bringing Your Full Self to Work.
Code switching does not protect you. You still Black. You still a woman. You still, you know, insert identity here. Code switching is not going to help you. And I think being able to push back against that to my own parents' teachings makes me incredibly unruly. If I can push back against my parents, you think I give a fuck about what you're telling me? These people raised me.
That's next week on Black and Published. I'll talk to you then. Peace.
What's going on, family? This is Derek Young.
And Ramonda Young.
Owners of both Mahogany Books and the Mahogany Books Podcast Network.
We really want to thank each and every one of you for listening to this episode. And if you enjoyed what you just heard, drop us a review and rate us on whatever platform you download podcasts on.
We truly appreciate each and every one of you for supporting us and making us your go-to for Black books. And we look forward to connecting with you all sometime in the future.
Thank you again, fam. And always remember, Black books matter.